Cool. So this is Mons, and you're also here, Timo.
Yes.
Yes, and this is Malmö Civic Lab, and we're sitting here in the Stadshus in Malmö, Sweden. And we're talking to Jacqueline. Can you tell us a little bit more about you, Jacqueline?
Absolutely. Good morning. My name is Jacqueline Youngblood. I'm the Chief of Staff with the City of Boston Mayor's Office of New Urban Mechanics. And the Mayor's Office of New Urban Mechanics, which we often call MONUM, which is its acronym, or New Urban Mechanics, has been around for about 10 years in the City of Boston. And we are the city's civic R&D lab, research and design, relationships and development, whatever you sort of want that R&D to stand for, we are here for it. And we take a very people-centric approach to sort of thinking about how can we improve local government? How can we improve the services, the experiences that residents have in our city? I think long before the sort of vocabulary around human-centered design came about, we were really trying to bring that into local government. So we were founded under a previous mayor, Mayor Menino, who was called the urban mechanic. And so that's where the name comes from.
Okay.
The idea was really that everyone can be an urban mechanic and everyone can think about, you know, what they can do, what they can contribute, how they can help their neighbors to make the city really great. And we've been very fortunate as a team that under the current mayor of Boston, Mayor Walsh, the team has actually grown a lot. We've gotten a number of grants. And so now we're a team of 10 people. And we work with any city department that wants to work with us. And usually, I would say, you know, 99% of the time, we have an external partner as well, whether that's a resident, a researcher, a startup, a large company, an artist, to try something small, to just prototype something, put it out in the public realm, get people's reactions. It's not so scary, right? We're trying to de-risk projects for departments so that they can see what might happen if they were to try something in this different way. So we're very much a sort of action-oriented group, very interdisciplinary, and we always work with and through other city departments' agendas and goals so that they make sure that they're doing their work, but also, you know, asking a different set of questions or having a slightly different sort of evaluation mechanism than what they might otherwise use. So that's a little bit of what we do, and I'm sure we'll get into it a little bit more, but my role within the team is sort of twofold. I have a couple of projects that I work on, largely around food access, public education, thinking about sort of active democratic practices, and then thinking about our international collaborations, partially why we're here today on this show. running our fellowship programs, which we'll also get into, and helping to coordinate some of the other sort of administrative things that we do here.
Super nice. Just about you, Jacqueline, where's your background before joining the City of Boston, and why did you join?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I moved to Boston about 5 years ago, so I'm not native to Boston. Before that, I lived in Houston, Texas. I've always been fascinated by cities. I've also lived in Berlin before, and I think my academic background is in history and really thinking about whose stories get told and how and what is the role of power in that and how is that sort of situated in place and places. And so coming out of my history degree, I started working at a nonprofit doing sort of organizational development, leadership training, you know, things I was very qualified to talk about. And then after about 5 years at that organization, moved up to Boston to work for a sort of consulting firm that worked with small businesses and nonprofits who were trying to expand their reach or grow their impact, largely through winning big contracts with things like, you know, hospitals, universities, cities. And so I got to sort of see what the City of Boston was up to in that role. And then this position with the mechanics opened up and sort of serendipitously found my way there and went through the interview process, and that was 4 years ago. So it's been really wonderful and really, yeah, fortunate to be in such an interesting interdisciplinary team who are all really, really passionate about cities and what makes cities work and why are they at times joyful, chaotic, you know, places of of disagreement, but also, you know, coordination. It's just, they're endlessly fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah, we actually didn't mention that before. Like, we actually had the pleasure of meeting in person because you reached out to us when you were on visiting Malmö. So yeah, we got to know you a little bit beforehand. Yeah. And then during that conversation, I think like I found, and you mentioned it now too, quite interesting with the way that you can de-risk the organization by just having another umbrella, right, where you can run experiments. Four different departments, but are capable of saying, like, look, this is an experiment. They might take it on or they might not take it on. Right. And then, yeah. But do you have any, like, success stories there that that stand out where the collaboration with different departments went really, really well?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a number of our projects come to mind, but I'll briefly share one that I was pretty close with. So mm-hmm. in the U.S., there's a federally funded summer meals program so that we make sure that young people have access to healthy food over the summer when they're not in school, where their meals are often coming from. And so this program had been running in Boston for a number of years, but had never been hosted at one of our municipal buildings. So City Hall had never been a site where young people could get a free meal in the summer. The school department headquarters hadn't been a site. And I think it was a question of the city's Office of Food Access, not really seeing it as sort of their jurisdiction, the Boston Public Schools Food and Nutrition Services team, which runs the program at other sites, you know, feeling overwhelmed and maybe feeling like this isn't an area where they wanted to sort of try it out. There were a lot of questions, you know, how can we make sure that the fridge is safe? Who's going to wheel it in and out every day? You know, how many young people are actually in the downtown area where City Hall is. So really the role that New Urban Mechanics played was sort of twofold. Again, thinking about how do we kick the tires a little bit? How do we show you that this is possible? And not only is it possible, but it's actually deeply meaningful to the young people and their families who experience this service. So imagine you're a grandmother or a mother, and you need to come to City Hall to get somebody's death certificate, or you need to come to City Hall to pay a ticket or pay some taxes, right? Not necessarily a positive experience. And maybe you have a young person with you, you know, maybe you have a 6-year-old niece or nephew or something, and you come to City Hall. And if you Google a picture of Boston City Hall, it's a pretty overwhelming looking building. It's actually the site of a lot of zombie apocalypse video game sets. So I think the building is beautiful, but it often doesn't do us many favors in terms of having people think that this is a place for them, that this is their building. And so you come to City Hall, it's an overwhelming building, you're here to do something unpleasant. And at the end of that, you walk out of the building and somebody is offering your kid, your grandkid, a free healthy meal and, you know, encouraging you to sit at the picnic tables that are just outside and enjoy the summer day and maybe play some games. And that really changes people's expectations of what their local government can be for them, but also what they can do in that space. What is theirs? What is, what do you think about when we talk about civic infrastructure? And who has agency to act in those spaces? And so in that first summer when we tried it out with the Office of Food Access and the Boston Public Schools Food and Nutrition Services team, we served about 1,000 meals over the course of 8 weeks, which is not, you know, the most meals, but it was really wonderful to get to talk to the young people who were working in the area who said, you know, otherwise I would have to pay $10 a day for lunch in this area because it's downtown. And so having this free resource was really helpful to, you know, 5- and 6-year-olds who came back almost every day who were just really excited to get to choose between a couple of different options. And so the program was in its third year this summer, and New Urban Mechanics is no longer actively involved. The Office of Food Access has hired temporary staff to run the program. They've come up with a lot of new activities. There's a, you know, a reading day that comes along, and kids get a free book in addition to the free meal. They do it at other municipal buildings now. So the school department headquarters is a site, as well as some library branches. So it's really grown beyond us, but I think you know, I think in conversations with them, they wouldn't have tried it if it weren't for us. And now we're bringing, you know, thousands of extra meals to young people across the city, while also changing their expectations of what a municipal building can do for them and what it can be for them. So that was a pretty fun one.
How about that, Jacqueline? Because I there is like two things that are happening that actually happens before. There is, Timo mentioned the word de-risk, which I think is quite interesting. It's not like my most used word, being Swedish native speaking, but you also mentioned it a little bit in like all the, it's like, I can recognize myself so much in that with this organization that just is very problem seeking before we actually do something, yeah, right?
Yeah.
It's like, can you tell us a little bit more about that? What were the issues that people were feeling? Like you saying they can't be in this building and why not and so on. What were the problem arising and why do you think we are such a problem seeking organization, if I can say that?
Yeah. I mean, I think every context is different, right? But one of the things that I think a lot of our colleagues here in Boston are worried about, and reasonably so, is liability, right? The question of who's going to be responsible if, especially when you're talking about young people and food related things, what if there's a health issue that arises, that's terrible, right? That's the worst case scenario. But even something on the very other end of the spectrum that's less, you know, catastrophic, but not good or not helpful. Like one example that somebody gave me was, well, you know, what if somebody comes and takes a baseball bat and starts whacking the fridge? Why would somebody do that, right?
Yeah.
And so I think, and Timo, I don't know if we talked about this when I was there with you, but it's very similar. We as a team have heard this a lot over the 10 years that we've been around. Maybe 5 or 6 years ago, we literally rolled out some fake turf to put out on City Hall Plaza. Again, if you Google Boston City Hall Plaza, you'll see why it needs some fake grass. And we wanted to buy these $20 plastic sort of lawn chairs. And we had so many meetings of, you know, different level staff of different departments. And they were saying, well, what if people steal the chairs and what are we going to do? And at some point, someone on my team said, okay, here's how expensive all of these meetings have been about talking about what we're going to do if someone steals a $20 chair. Like, we'll just replace it. It's okay. And so I think we often, as an organization and as local governments, we often don't think about the cost of the status quo or the cost of the catastrophizing that we tend to do because we're so worried. Again, reasonably, right? We're talking about providing services to people, often vulnerable populations. Totally reasonable to have that fear. But it makes it, I think, hard to think beyond what you're currently doing and try something new and have a space where that's okay. Sorry, I'm getting some messages from a colleague. And so I think with the summer meals example, it was very much worried about, you know, storage and, well, who is going to wheel the fridge in and out of the security at the front desk every day, and the security sort of mechanism was brand new, so they were worried about denting it and, you know, dinging it as the fridge rolled by. You know, it was very sort of tactical, logistical things that are easy to imagine would go wrong, but until you actually do it, you can't know for sure that, oh, actually, this isn't a big deal. This is totally fine. So it's just super interesting from a sort of testing and kind of prototyping perspective. We often talk about our work as experiments, which, not to say we're experimenting on people, but this sort of provocation that what if government were driven by hypotheses? What if we had questions and then we sought to answer those questions, or we sought to understand how those questions actually play out in people's lives versus the sort of 20-year planning process. We know the right answer a priori. That's just not how people's lives work in cities, I think. And so being willing to have a place to sort of take those risks is one of the reasons that Nanox exists.
I think it's super interesting. I think we face it so much, me and Timo too, and it's like, what is the cost of control versus the cost of letting go and just do things and the actionable and always the people seeking out those, like you say, what if someone comes smashing with a baseball bat? I mean, it's not very likely. And if that happens, then we need to deal with that. We can't take consideration on that beforehand, kind of. It's like, Right. It's really, really interesting. But the opposite of it, and that I just want to mention too, is like, and I think me and Timo needs to call each other out on this sometimes often too, is that because you get to do all those meetings before you get anything done or launched or out there or so on, the other part is this kind of psychological ownership that builds, because now you spend so much time on actually establishing this, which I, in my former role, you know, you just went out and bought the chairs and put them on the square and then saw what happened. And so that meant if we needed to take them away, I wouldn't get emotionally hurt. But now I put so much effort into actually making it happen that if someone says, maybe it's better we do it this way, I'm going to be like defensive about it. Mm. And I don't like this at all, but it happens. Mm-hmm. And it's the process that makes it happen. It's not, and I don't know if you see the same, but I think it's one of the things that I think about a lot. And
yeah, it's super interesting. No specific projects come to mind at the moment, but I absolutely can identify with the feeling of, how do you sort of divorce yourself enough from the current prototype or the current idea to be willing to allow for other concepts or to allow for those iterations? And I think it's a weird, it takes a sort of strange set of characteristics. And so that sort of gets into the makeup of the team in my mind of how do you both cultivate a sense of confidence and willingness to sort of push through and around the obstacles that you are likely to face doing this kind of work, this civic innovation work, but also be humble and vulnerable and curious and have enough of an imposter complex to say, I'm actually not the expert in this scenario. It's actually the food and nutrition services folks. And they know way more about, food safety, and the property management folks know way more about how the building works and what's not going to be successful. But balancing those two enough to say, okay, let's keep trying. And if this current idea doesn't work, let's just switch. That's totally okay. It's not my expertise on the line. I don't have that level of ego in it. But yeah, I don't know. I'm sort of
right. But I can also feel like we discard ideas along the way. So, mm-hmm. so like we as we develop, the mm-hmm. problem is that the process of getting it done, there's kind of this, okay, now we know what we want to do. And then you start the process of going through legal and checking if it's possible and who we need to talk to and blah, blah, blah. And then somewhere along the line, you figure out that maybe this wasn't the right thing. There's something else that we might want to do. But then we also know, oh, Jesus, that's a 4-week. Now we need to start over because now we changed the requirements a little bit here. Mm-hmm. And now, let's not do that because then we need to start over again and start talking with legal and start doing this. And start. But I think that's very interesting from a prototyping mindset, which back in the day, I didn't think that much about. If we want to change something, we just did. Mm. And that was fine, right? Because it was conceptually true to what we wanted to achieve. It wasn't like in the specifics, which it's a lot here. Yeah. It was just like, we want to do something here and then whatever turned out. Mm. So,
yeah.
But I think also what you said with the like building hypothesis and working on hypothesis and goals, then basically like if that is your setup, then you're the implementation of like the current prototype is kind of like, it's not the goal in itself.
No.
So it might also help into like kind of staying a bit detached from the current solutions. Like we have this hypothesis that we want to prove or disprove. Is that tool that we're trying right now helping us that way? Nope. Okay. So I think that can help for sure help in discarding or evaluating if you're on the right track or not.
I think it's important too to be honest with your collaborators internally and externally for sure. That is what might happen, right? I think so often we talk about at the beginning, like, hey, you're working with the civic innovation team. We're working together. Things are going to get a little messy. It's probably going to end up somewhere totally different than what we think today because we can't know the answer in advance. And so how you build those relationships and how you build that trust with your collaborators, I think starts to build that muscle of being comfortable making those shifts halfway through, even if it means going back to legal. And it's going to be another couple of weeks on the process. But also thinking about how can we sort of shorten that feedback loop where every time we have to go back to legal, it doesn't have to be another 4 weeks. So it's there's a lot of moving parts, but I think trust is a big part of it.
Yeah, absolutely agree. So I think when we had the talk last time, I think two things were really sticking out. And one of them was that you guys are having open office hours. And I really would like to hear, what is it about and how does it work? And
Yeah, sure. So we've been doing this certainly since I've been here, but I want to say from the beginning of Monum's time. So generally speaking, everybody on the team holds 3 hours on Tuesday afternoons and 3 hours on Thursday mornings for office hours. And we've tried lots of different things over the years, hosting them here at City Hall in our space, so that people can sort of see what our team environment looks like. They can get a sense, again, that the building's not so scary. We've tried hosting them out in the neighborhood branches of the public library system. We've tried hosting them at the school department, trying to meet people where they are. Often people will find out about us somehow, and then they'll email us and say, oh, I'd love to come in for office hours. And so that's one way. People definitely just walk in to City Hall, and then they ask reception if we're available. And if we are, we'll meet with them. And if not,
who walk in and what do they want?
Yeah, anybody. It could be a resident. It could be someone who's visiting from another country who's like, oh, I'm only here for 2 days and someone told me I should meet with the new urban mechanics. I was wondering if they were available. So it spans the gamut. A lot of times it's entrepreneurs, social entrepreneurs, startups wanting to pitch their idea to the city, not necessarily for us to consider buying the thing. I think at this point, startups are sophisticated enough to know that there's procurement laws and there's ways that you sell to cities, and pitching the civic innovation team, it probably isn't one of them. But they actually really want feedback on how their product or service would impact residents, or how it would work in cities, or what are their blind spots about how people interact with space that, you know, would be helpful to them. So it's often startups looking for feedback. It's often residents trying to ask us to do something, to build a project with them, to help connect them to someone. I think we are often, we're sort of a front door, and we can help translate, okay, you have this request. Actually, the department that you want to talk to is the Public Health Commission. It's not the Public Health Department. So we do a lot of that sort of bureaucratic organizational translation, because it's unreasonable to expect residents to know who in the city is responsible for starting a food truck business, right? That's not something that we should expect people to be able to figure out. We can just help them find that. So it really ranges. And then, you know, sometimes the conversation is just a pleasant conversation and we met somebody interesting, but it doesn't go any further than that. Sometimes it actually turns into a project. Sometimes we connect them to some of our university partners who we know are doing research in that area, because they might be able to be helpful. So it really depends case by case with each office hours, but it's been fascinating over the years to sort of see the range and breadth of people that we've met, connections we've been able to make, things we've learned about that we didn't know about before. And also a big part of it is, if there's a bad idea, telling people that that's a bad idea. It's not just about, you know, saying, oh yes, this is wonderful and you should keep doing this. It's really about being sort of a critical partner and saying, you know, here are the ways where you may want to improve on your idea, or here's how this doesn't really make sense given the goals that the city has laid out in all of our various plans, or, oh, did you consider, you know, public value versus private value, and how our responsibility isn't to one specific quote unquote segment of the market, but we actually need to serve all of our residents. And in fact, we've made a stake to say that we will serve our residents equitably, which does mean that in some cases we'll be prioritizing, you know, vulnerable populations over others. And that can be an uncomfortable conversation to have with residents.
How much of it is like internal people coming from that's actually employed by the city?
That's a good question. I would say through office hours or just randomly coming up to our office, which we keep open. So even when it's not the scheduled office hours, maybe 20% internal and 80% external. At this point, our internal collaborators know where and how to find us. And so they generally don't go through office hours, but we definitely are constantly on the lookout for new partners internally, keeping our ears to the ground on what's happening. We like to stick our noses into everybody's projects and business, and hopefully that's a welcome partnership. But yeah, I would say it's mostly external folks. Mm.
But I mean, I think, like, as you mentioned, of course, sometimes it leads to something, sometimes it leads to nothing. But I think just in itself, the having the ear on the ground is a super, super important thing. And just being like getting the reality check of those are actually the things that people are concerned with. And then if you might agree or disagree, right, is a completely different story. But at least you know, okay, this kind of demographics are interested in this area, or like are super annoyed about this and that.
Exactly.
So that is super good. Yeah. Were there any concrete projects that came about that you think, like, that were citizen initiated that you ended up going through with?
Let's see. Yeah, I mean, there's lots. Trying to think of some recent ones. I mean, this wasn't a direct sort of connection, but it was an interesting turn of events. So we had someone who had just moved to Boston from Finland, and she really thought that Boston should have Finnish saunas, that it would be a great thing for Boston to have. And so we talked, you know, she had a whole pitch deck and all the benefits. And so we talked to her for a while, and we tried to connect her with the inspectional services folks who would probably oversee something like that. I don't think that went anywhere, but like 6 months later, a couple of artists were working through a nonprofit organization to host a temporary sauna over on the harbor. And so we were able to connect the artists with the resident who had reached out to us saying, hey, like, I know this isn't exactly what you were talking about, but maybe it would be interesting for you to go check out this artist's. It was a fully working sauna, like beautiful, somebody's, you know, master's in architecture project. But it was really, really interesting to hear how the artists had gone through the permitting and all of that, and to be able to connect them with the resident to say, you know, you're both interested in the same things, like maybe you could work together, was kind of a cool thing. And that was maybe a year ago. And I think the artists are trying to bring the sauna back to a second location. So trying to think about how we expand that circle of collaborators and you know, who's co-designing what with whom. I think a lot of sort of computer visioning AI type startups will come in and they'll say, hey, we can do, you know, this particular thing that you all are interested in related to, you know, parking occupancy, or you know, thinking about how pedestrians move through a street, and we'll try and see if there's a way that we can sort of use a kind of, I hate to say the phrase testbed, but like, is there a block that we know we're having a challenge on, and would you be willing to sort of demo your products there, just to help us understand the scope of the problem a little bit more, and for you to actually field test the technology. That's definitely happened on a number of occasions. It often, the more successful examples often come through sort of just general connections or word of mouth rather than necessarily through office hours, but it'll be you know, a research lab out of a university, or it'll be a set of artists who want to activate empty storefronts, and they'll find us somehow. So I think if you imagine that open office hours is just the team at large, then there's half of our projects come through that channel, I would say.
Mm. You mentioned the university a couple times now, and then we talked before about, right, that you have at the City of Boston, we have a fellowship program as well during the summer. And that sounded like it's a super big success. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, for sure. So when New Urban Mechanics started, it was two people. And I think part of the genius of those two very smart people was acknowledging their own limits and their, you know, their gaps. And so from the beginning, New Urban Mechanics has worked with our university collaborators. And here in Boston, we're extremely fortunate to have so many universities. And so thinking about how do we share enough of what we're working on and thinking about, and how do we build relationships with professors that are mutually interesting, not just, oh, let's get both legal teams, as we were talking about, to sort of sign an MOU and have this agreement about how the university and the city are going to work together. It's much more on a sort of class by class or professor by professor basis. And I think as we, you know, sort of undertook that work, realized that having a summer fellowship program could help us not only deepen those relationships with some of the institutions, but also extend and expand our own capacity as a team. So over the years, we've grown from, you know, hosting maybe 4 to 5 people over the summer to this past summer, we had 12. And it's been really interesting. And I'm proud that over the last couple of years, we've expanded to not just people who are affiliated with universities. So generally, the fellows are graduate students in the middle of, you know, a 2-year program that summer in between. But this year we had folks who were not tied to a university in any way. We've had folks who come to us while they're still in undergrad. So that's interesting. We've had teachers apply in the past, people who are mid-career architects. So it's really nice to see the range of people who are applying grow in that way. I think we see the fellowship as a couple of things. It's a way for people to consider working in local government long-term for a lot of, you know, a lot of folks who sort of come through a kind of political science or policy track, they often think federal government. And we're trying to make the case that local government is super interesting. It's where the direct interactions with people happen. It's where you really see sort of policy implementation. And it could be the path for you. And so if you spend 8 weeks with us, you'll see a little bit how it works and get a little bit of our mindset and ethos. And then if you choose to come back, hopefully you'll take that spirit of experimentation and prototyping and being very resident driven with you to whatever that department is or whatever that city is, even if it's not Boston. And then on the other hand, people who would never consider working in local government to say, hey, this is actually a totally viable option. This is really meaningful work. It's extremely interesting. It has direct impact. And so that's a little bit how we get to the interdisciplinarity of the cohort, which I think is a key component of our summer fellowship is having this cohort of people who are working together. They each have their own projects that they're responsible for, but it's really about leveraging the skills of the other people in the cohort or understanding how they would approach a problem or the project, having extra hands when you need, you know, to be out in the public realm doing things. So that's one of the fellowships that we run is the summer one. We also as a team run a year-long fellowship. And so that's kind of similar, but just for 12 months instead of 8 weeks. And that's been running for almost the entire time that New Urban Mechanics has been around. And a lot of the team comes through those fellowships, and then afterwards we'll go on somewhere else in the city. So that's interesting. And then I would say the third sort of area that we've been exploring over the last couple of years are kind of international exchanges or international fellowships. So we've had a couple through the State Department over the last couple of years and trying to think about, you know, what is a meaningful 1-month project? What is something that somebody can learn, sort of get up to speed on in 4 weeks, do something meaningful, contribute, but also take that sort of ethos back with them. And then what would it look like to do that in a sort of simultaneous exchange? And who would fund that, right? And like, what are all of the HR applications involved in that? But knowing that, I think really prioritizing learning and knowledge sharing and the privilege that we have here in Boston to have a team of 10 people doing this work that a lot of other cities don't have that available to them, both internationally, but also right around the corner from us, right? There's lots of towns in the greater Boston area that certainly do not have a team like ours. And so how do we start to think about our responsibility sort of in the field, regionally, domestically, and internationally?
Cool. Yeah. Are the people, the fellows, are they applying with a concrete problem, or are you kind of like telling them those are problem areas we want to explore this summer? Or
it's a point of contention every summer because we tell the fellows, okay, we're not going to tell you your project until day one. And they always want to know in advance what it's going to be so that they can read up on it and get ready. But the truth of the matter is while we're selecting the candidates, we're also running around trying to source projects from our partner departments. So it takes until the very last day before they get here to figure out okay, what's the mix of projects? We want some of them to be much more exploratory. We want some of them to be very much in the experimental phase. Maybe one or two are sort of in the evaluation sort of process, figuring out, you know, what are the first couple of meetings that they should have, trying to seed it so that they can hit the ground running, going from zero knowledge about the topic, perhaps. And we often try and sort of match the person based on their skills and their interests with a project that's like 1 degree different from what they might want to do. So, example, this past summer, we had someone who had a really strong background in sort of data analysis and transportation. We had a person who had a really strong background in community engagement and sort of theater and early childhood development. And instead of putting the first person with the transportation, data background on this project about vehicle safety and sort of trucks moving through the city, we put the second person on it to say, you'll have that first person to tap onto to leverage right. her skills and her expertise. But we're actually really curious how you, as a person with a theater background and a family engagement background, would approach this question about truck safety. So it's always a little uncomfortable, and we try and be very, very upfront and honest with the fellows about it. But no, we assign them their projects on day one, and then we work with them for 8 weeks as they go on the roller coaster of emotions and, you know, all the phases of the project until the sort of last week where they have hopefully gone out and done some prototyping in the public realm, and then they present back on that.
And then you those end results, are you having like a big demo day with the entire organization, or how do you feed it back into the different departments?
Yeah, so it takes a couple of forms. One is a series of kind of lightning talks. So this summer we had, it was a standing room only. There were like 100 people from the different departments who hosted the fellows. And people tell us, you know, oh, this is my favorite day of the summer. I love coming to hear the mechanics fellows talk about their work because it's such a broad range of topics. It goes from, you know, emergency medical services, language access to technology in the public realm. It's such a wide spread of projects. But then each fellow will often do a department specific report back. They'll invite people actually out into, you know, spaces to do their prototyping with them. So it really kind of depends on the project. But I think that big sort of reveal of, you know, what we found and what we learned is really inspiring and invigorating for city staff. And it's also a chance for us to say, you know, hey, here are 12 really qualified people that you can hire the next time that you have an opening. And we often get people coming up to us directly after that saying, oh, what's so-and-so's background? Her project was really interesting and she came at it in a really interesting way. Is she available? Like, can I hire her right now?
Nice. Yeah. No, I mean, and also for other cities, I mean, you were so kind and brought some material, and I looked on, so I can recommend anybody checking out the stuff that they're doing, for sure. But there's a lot of inspiration there, too, where it's like, it feels like, okay, like, you did the hard work now, but they're like, we can definitely, like, yeah, piggyback off that and try implementing some of that on our own side. So I think, like, two things that you shared, I think that are super interesting to me was the, we've been working on this kind of citizen error reporting thing as well. And you mentioned that you have this, I think Boston 311 it's called.
Yeah.
This app. And then you did last year, I think, some research and basically figured out that, well, it turns out that when it comes to sidewalk quality or street quality, that it actually ends up being poor street quality in lower income areas than it is in others. And I think that that's a super interesting question that we want to dig into as well. We don't have the data on it, and I'm not 100% certain what our all the input channels are, but if I just look at our error reporting system that we have in place now, you can see for sure that the amount of error reports in the inner city or in the wealthier parts of the city are way higher than in the less wealthy parts.
Yeah.
So I think like super interesting work you guys are doing there.
Yeah, thanks.
Does it lead to anything? Like, what are the so if the results come in, and how do we proportionally then feed back to the areas that doesn't report as much, or how do we deal with infrastructure in terms of those are the areas where, you know, it might not be worse, it's just that they don't report, and then could we use the error reporting data as something that, okay, maybe we need to go out and check more? Or do you do anything like more practical with the data, or it's just
Yeah. So a couple of things come to mind. So one, as we looked and saw, you know, that there's clear gaps in where the reports are coming from, we thought about like who could be the messenger to say, this service exists. This is a thing that the city is offering to you, because maybe we as the city are not the trusted party. And so the message doesn't land when we say, hey, use our 311 app or call it in, that's not a trusted source of information. So we actually had a gym teacher from one of the schools in a neighborhood where there weren't as many reports, who wrote up his own sort of how-to guide for the families of his school, saying, hey, look at all of these reports in this other neighborhood. We don't have any or nearly as many. And so our concerns are going unanswered. And so he sort of became the trusted partner to think about how to get more people to consider using the service to report concerns. Mm. And so taking that and thinking about, okay, who are the other potential champions? Is it librarians? Who are the people that residents are interacting with on a daily basis that they might go to for that information? So that's sort of on the gap in the reporting side. I think on the what do we do with the information side, you know, previously we would basically just respond to requests in the queue in the order that they came in. And so the more that you tell us your sidewalk is broken, the more that we will come and fix it. And that obviously leads to a number of challenges. And so through sort of identifying that there was this equity gap in reports provided versus sidewalk quality, we've started actually to proactively plan our long-term capital investments based on what we know about the sort of sidewalk quality based on what the public works team has observed. So they go out and they walk the sidewalks and they have a methodology that they use to say, okay, there's this many cracks per this many meters. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to use that. We're going to overlay that with the 311 data. And then we're going to overlay that with a third layer of sort of broad social vulnerability index based on some census tract data. To say, okay, proactively, we're going to prioritize this network of sidewalks rather than doing these one-off fixes that may not contribute to walkability because we're just responding to a squeaky wheel. But instead, we're actually going to prioritize, you know, these connections or this network of sidewalk repairs and reconstruction, regardless of what we're hearing from the app. And so it's still in progress, but we were fortunate to get a grant to sort of do that initial work, to do some research with some university partners, but also to support the work of the public works team who go out and do those repairs. So still in progress. Stay tuned.
Very cool. Right. I know that we have a hard cut now. So, is there anything you want to plug before we say goodbye?
Just that our fellowship applications will open in a couple of months. So if anybody who listens to your podcast is interested in spending 8 weeks in Boston, we'd be more than happy to have you. The link is boston.gov/monum. That's MONUM-fellowship. You can also just Google it and I'm sure you'll find it, but would love to have lots of folks apply, throw their hat in the ring. And as always, feel free to reach out via email. We're always happy to chat and think about who's doing cool stuff across the world.
Cool. And it's also open to international people, fellowship.
Yeah.
Or that's only, yeah. Perfect.
We'll right. spread it around.
We'll too. Spread it too. Yeah.
Thank you so much for taking your time, Jacqueline. Yeah. It's been a pleasure and we would love to hear back from you sooner or later.
Yes.
That sounds good. Thanks to you both. Yeah. Take care.
Great. Thank you. Bye.